And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Welcome to the first Inside Scoop broadcast in the Obama era. That's right, this is the first time I've been able to talk to you since President Obama became President Obama, and if I'm like any of you, I've got a bit of a hangover. You may notice that my voice is hoarse. I'm pretty tired, as I know is also Bob Kincaid and Guy James. After attending the inauguration and all its festivities, we attended a progressive media summit yesterday, which is why maybe you didn't hear a little bit from us. And so we're all pretty tired. And I'm hungover not just personally, but also with regard to, well, the Republicans. You see, after the celebrations were over, very, very quickly after the celebrations were over, in the first hours of the Obama presidency Wednesday morning, not 24 hours after he'd been inaugurated, the Republican Party declared war on our new president. Talk about lack of a honeymoon. They didn't give him a day. That's right. The Republicans have declared their fervent desire that our new president fail. Indeed, in the words of the rotund leader of the idiots, the drug-addled Rush Limbaugh, that was a direct quote. I hope he fails. But Republicans in Congress are taking Rush Limbaugh up, following their idiot leader, to the obvious conclusion. Case in point, Arlen Specter, senator from Pennsylvania, a guy who calls himself a moderate, has done something unprecedented in American history. He's held up the nomination of Barack Obama's intended Attorney General, Eric Holder, for a week, doing so even though Specter has said he supports Holder. Why? Is it to go over more of the Mark Rich pardon? I don't think so. Eric Holder's already said everything there is to say about that. There's no new information. He's been very clear about what he did. He made some mistakes in, you know, giving that advice, but it was President Clinton's pardon. It's kind of hard to tar Eric Holder with it, who's an otherwise exemplary public servant, former D.C. court judge and prosecutor, very, very well respected on both sides of the aisle. No, the reason Specter's holding it up is because a number of people in the Republican Party fear that George Bush's cronies will be tried for their flagrant breaches of the Constitution. You and I and everyone else knows that in the past administration, the Constitution was treated, let's just say, like an advisory piece of writing. Oh, if you want to obey the Bill of Rights, you can, but you don't have to. And I would like to focus on the new administration. I would like to focus on the future. I would like to give Obama a chance, but the Republicans are determined to subvert the will of the 82% of Americans who currently approve of Barack Obama. That's not just the 54% or so that voted for him, but an additional 28% or so that wants him to do well. No, they're representing the 18% that want him to do badly, that want him to fail, because they're following their ditto head leader, Rush Limbaugh. And the thing they care most about, the thing they care most about above everything else, is allowing people to get away with breaking the law, with torture, with, if Patrick Fitzgerald hints are right, the special prosecutor appointed to check out what Dick Cheney did, even treason is, in the Republican view, not really a crime. So they're using this to put pressure on the soon-to-be attorney general, even though everyone knows he's going to get nominated. Everyone knows he's got more than enough votes, even if they tried to filibuster the guy. He's very well respected. But they're trying to say and make him promise that he won't prosecute former Bush officials for criminal, lawless behavior, for war crimes, for treason, for secret prisons, for torture, for surveilling hundreds of millions of Americans without a warrant, for putting people in jail without access to lawyers indefinitely without even knowledge of their crimes, or should I say alleged crimes, since many of them were never proved, and many of them the administration later admitted never committed crimes to begin with. Now, Barack Obama has taken a dramatic step on day one, yesterday, of his administration. On his first day in office, he signed a directive to begin the process of closing down Guantanamo Bay. On his first day in office, he signed a directive calling waterboarding what it is, torture, and stopping it, not just for the Army, but for the CIA as well. On his first day, Barack Obama closed down secret prisons. And what's fascinating about all these executive orders is they weren't new law. You see, a president can only issue an executive order if he's executing an act of Congress. See, the president can issue executive orders fulfilling a law, fulfilling a bill passed by Congress, and kind of filling in the details. If Congress doesn't define torture, the president can decide what it is. If Congress doesn't make, you know, says we can't have secret prisons, it's the president's job to direct it, to issue that executive order. But he didn't need a law passed by Congress because these things were already the law. All he had to do was act pursuant to the laws on the books. And therein lies the problem for Republicans. You see, the laws on the books already prohibit torture. The United States is already a signatory to the Hague Conventions, which require us to act humanely to prisoners of war, require us not to torture people or put people in secret prisons, which means that those that do can be prosecuted. More than 100 years ago, our soldiers in the Spanish-American War waterboarded some of the prisoners they captured. And our soldiers were court-martialed under existing U.S. law. During World War II, the Japanese waterboarded some of our guys. We executed them for their war crimes. And now that we know that waterboarding and other forms of torture were approved at the very top, that Abu Ghraib was not an accident, that these kinds of specific tortures were discussed at the highest levels, and that includes Dick Cheney and his putative boss, George W. Bush. The question is whether these officials can be prosecuted. And the Republicans don't want to see it happen. And so they're already declaring war on Obama. They're already laying the gauntlet. They're already telling Obama, Obama, if you choose to enforce the United States Constitution, we're all over you like a toupee on a bald man. We want to cover you up. We want to smother you. We want you to fail. Because there's nothing Republicans hate more than the Constitution. There's nothing they hate more than the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights is a threat to every single tyrannical leader of the United States. How are you going to rule tyrannically if you can't watch everybody? If you have to go get a warrant every time you want to spy on someone? How can you be a tyrant if you give people the right to a trial? If you tell them what crimes they're accused of? If you have to put them in prison pursuant to basic human rights standards? I mean, if we prosecute these officials for breaking the law, for breaking the Constitution, for violating the Bill of Rights, that will serve as a lesson to future generations. Don't do it again. But Republicans want to do it again. They want to be able to pick up any American citizen in the middle of the night, put them in prison without trial forever, and without access to an attorney. They want to be able to treat Americans as Stalin treated Soviet citizens. And who stands in their way? The newly elected President of the United States and his Attorney General designee, Eric Holder, who believes that, guess what, torture is torture, waterboarding is torture, and torture is illegal. So they're trying to weaken the man. And Arlen Specter, knowing he can't dare vote against him in the blue state of Pennsylvania, is trying to delay things a week, something that's never been done before. And I ask those of you who live in Pennsylvania, and even those of you that don't, to call the Capitol Switchboard, 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121, and demand that Specter end his war on the new president. Because I'll tell you this, if Arlen Specter gets away with this 1 week of delay, what's next? What's next? Holds on other Obama nominees. I'm thinking of Clinton because Hillary Clinton did get approved as Secretary of State. But Eric Holder needs to appoint people who can prosecute wrongdoers. And there are statute of limitation issues coming up, including a very important one that expires on March 11th, the executive order and the willingness of Alberto Gonzalez to go around the law to allow the torture and the secret surveillance. I'm doing an entire show on this with an expert next week. You won't want to miss the next Thursday as I go through the crimes that the Bush administration, we know that they did, and that can be prosecuted if we can get people up and running prior to March 11th. What you can do, though, is help me out, help the Democrats out, help Obama out, and demand that Arlen Specter end his war on Obama. But I guess, you know, those of us who thought that Specter was a moderate, well, we weren't listening to Rush Limbaugh. Of course, that makes sense. You really have to be an idiot to listen to Rush Limbaugh unless you're doing, you know, monitoring him to find out what he's saying, as the people in Media Matters do. But Rush Limbaugh was quite frank about Obama. It is Limbaugh's view that government can never succeed. The government by the people, of the people, and for the people can never succeed. Rush Limbaugh's view is that Lincoln was an idiot for his belief that government could do anything good. It's his belief that government must fail, that the people's choices must fail. And certainly he has proven that when Republicans are in charge, when his people are in charge, when George W. Bush is in charge, they fail. That's easy. It's very easy if you don't believe in something to fail at it. It's very easy for those that don't believe in government to fail at it. But he pointed out that Barack Obama wants to use government to actually help people. And as Rush Limbaugh put it, he had a four-word response to that. I hope he fails. So, those of us that wondered what would progressive talk radio do when we controlled the presidency and both houses of Congress? We're not quite there, of course. We need 60 in the Senate. We only have 59, and we don't even have 59 yet. We have, 57. Al Franken's, though I think he will be seated, it's going to take a few months to finish that election. And then now that Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State, we need a new senator from New York. David Patterson is expected to pick this Saturday. And I, for one, am glad that Caroline Kennedy has taken her name out of the race. No particular disrespect to her, but I don't think she was ready to be a senator. Andrew Cuomo is a good name that's being put up, and there are other good names as well. I don't want to necessarily favor any one of them, but I'm glad Caroline Kennedy's out of the race. The point is we have 57 senators. We don't have even 59. We will. We'll have 59 in about 4 months, maybe less, maybe 2 months. But we still need 60 to break a filibuster. Even so, the Democrats do control most levers of power for the first time since 1993. And there are those that say, well, what's the purpose of progressive talk radio? What's the purpose of liberal talk radio if the Democrats are in control? And the answer is, well, a lot of things. One, we have to keep watching the Republicans from doing the dirty tricks like Arlen Specter did just yesterday, something that the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Pat Leahy, called unprecedented, and it was, and said he was very disappointed about, which is Congress speak for being hopping mad. It's not just to watch the Republicans. We have to watch the Democrats. We have to make sure that Obama is held to what he promised to do. So far, I have to say, in only one day, he's gotten off to a good start. In addition to banning torture, ending Guantanamo Bay, and getting rid of secret prisons, he set up new lobbying standards on his first day, making clear that no gifts, not gifts of a certain amount, no gifts can come from lobbyists. two members of his administration, and no one in his administration can leave office and lobby his administration as long as he's president. That could be up to 8 years. Maybe that'll stop some of the people from going into the government. That's fine by me. If your purpose of going into government is not to help the country, it's not to serve the president and the people, then it's only to lobby and make money afterwards, well, then you know what? You shouldn't be in government. He also changed presidential records. Now, I remember one of the first things I did when I worked on the Judiciary Committee of the House and did that work for Barney Frank. We tried to enforce the Presidential Records Act, which says that presidents that have been out 12 years, that they got to turn over those records. But George W. Bush wanted to protect his father's records. And he went back 25 years. He went back all the way to Ronald Reagan's presidency because his father was vice president then, and he wanted to keep things secret. So there was no basis in the law for that, but, you know, the president did it. Well, Obama has turned it around. He has said that for all presidential records, the burden of proof is on those that want to keep it secret, not the burden of proof on those that want to open the information to the public. But you have to have a compelling reason to keep it secret. So maybe we will find out what Dick Cheney was up to, what George Bush was up to. Now, there is a minimum period of 5 years. So we won't find out anything from the Bush presidency. We'll find out all the way through Clinton. We won't find anything from the Bush presidency for another 5 years. I'm afraid then that more statutes of limitations will have passed. But the idea of an open government is a very, very good thing. What else did Obama do on his first day? Well, he decided to keep government salaries of people over $100,000 frozen. I don't have a problem with that. He met with his economic team. He met with his generals. And he did as promised. He promised to find a plan to get us out of Iraq within the first 16 months. And apparently, he is already going through with that. He also called the leaders of Israel and Jordan and Egypt and the Palestinian Authority and made clear already his plan to support the reconstruction of Gaza, to help the Palestinian Authority, and most importantly, not to rearm Hamas, to do whatever he could to keep them from rearming. So he's working on the ground there. Meanwhile, his other appointees, Hillary Clinton, sailed through 94-2. Not bad. The only ones to oppose her were Jim DeMint of South Carolina and David Vitter of Louisiana. David Vitter, the man who did the same thing that Elliot Spitzer did, hanging out with prostitutes, but apparently, yeah, well, he's still in Congress. Then there was Tim Geithner. Now, Tim Geithner is an interesting choice. He seems like a decent choice. I mean, I'm not going to condemn the man before he gets started. He does seem to be someone who's sort of a creative mind, a creative thinker, has been criticized and also praised for being behind some of the temporary assistance program, TARP, that George Bush set up, that Congress approved. Of course, we all know that a lot of that was done without any kind of monitoring to know exactly where the money was going. But he does seem to be a creative thinker. And I'm willing to give him a chance. What's interesting about him, though, is that he seems to have strong support politically on both sides of the aisle. And therefore, the quite severe things he's done, that is not paying his taxes, are overlooked. Compare him with Eric Holder. Now, Eric Holder is solidly in the tradition of the rule of law, solidly in the tradition of the Constitution. He's someone, therefore, that scares many Republicans who know that their friends have been breaking laws in the Bush administration, such as all those people in the Justice Department, which Holder will eventually head, that hired people illegally based on political reasons rather than the law. Think Monica Goodling, our graduate of the, 130th best law school out of 130 in the nation, the one founded by Jerry Falwell. So the Justice Department morale is as low as it's ever been because people know that they weren't there to serve justice, to serve the law, to serve the administration. they were there to serve the president at the expense of justice, law, and the administration. So they're looking for any peccadillo they can find on Holder. All they can find is Mark Rich pardon, which if you want to blame anyone, blame Bill Clinton. Holder admitted to some mistakes, but there's nothing new there. And yet, take a guy like Tim Geithner, and what did he do? Well, he didn't pay his taxes. Now, I know there's some excuses there. It was a complex thing. He worked for the International Monetary Fund, and because most of the people that work there are international, it gets complex over what exactly one should pay, and they don't take the money out in the paycheck. They let everyone pay it on their own. There's some complex issues there about self-employment tax. But this is the guy that's going to head Treasury. He's going to run the IRS. You think he would have taken the time to get it right? Now, he did pay it all back, and it was somewhat confusing, and he admitted to all his mistakes. And I'm not saying I'm against the nomination of Tim Geithner. I support it. My only point is that he's going to sail through, despite not paying taxes, while Holder's being holed up. And the reason for that is nothing to do with taxes or the pardon of Mark Rich. It has to do with the fact that Republicans like Geithner and they fear Holder, which tells me that we want to get as much of Eric Holder in there as soon as possible. And I really encourage all of you to write and call Arnold Spector. You can also call Pat Leahy and Harry Reid and let them know how important it is that his nomination go through. Because if the Republicans start this, this is just the tip of the iceberg, my friends. If they start here, then who knows how far they'll go in the war on Obama that their leader, Rush Limbaugh, has declared. You know, in the last week or two before the end of the last administration, there was news that, frankly, I think would have gotten a lot of news if it hadn't been for the excitement of the current Obama administration. And that is that the White House was fighting not to disclose documents. They wanted to cover up years and years and years of documents, including specifically the things the White House did to break the law and put in political appointees instead of regular appointees, those chosen based on merit. And they said years ago when sued by the Citizens for Responsible Ethics Watch crew, when they were sued by them, they said, oh, we can't find the emails, sorry. Oh, we changed servers, we lost 3 years of emails. Oh, well, I guess we violated the Presidential Records Act, but that's okay, we believe in secret government anyway. Well, finally, this thing wended its way through the courts. And finally, in the last days of the Bush administration, a judge said, turn them over or I'm holding you in contempt. Which means basically the judge could put some of them in jail if they didn't turn the records over. And lo and behold, the records showed up. Or at least they said they showed up. As Melanie Sloan of Crew said, I'll believe it when I see it. The point is that these emails, and I don't know what they say, but I suspect what they show, is the clear hand of Dick Cheney and Karl Rove in turning the Justice Department and other White House agencies from in charge of enforcing law and policy to in charge of enforcing politics. I think we're going to find there were emails from Karl Rove saying, prosecute any Democrat you can, and even some that you can't, and don't prosecute Republicans. We know, for example, that a number of the prosecutors that were fired, virtually all of them, in fact, had either been prosecuting Republicans like Carol Lamb, who prosecuted Duke Cunningham, the good old bribe-taking congressman from San Diego, the one that had a, you know, a menu for his bribes. Oh, pay me $100,000, I'll give you $10 million. Pay me $300,000, I'll give you, you know, $30 million. You can't prosecute Republicans when they commit bribery, Karl Rove said. Carol Lamb's out of a job. Now, did he say that? Well, maybe those emails will discover that. Maybe those emails will tell us exactly how and when Dick Cheney said, will someone be rid me of this troublesome priest? Will someone rid me of Valerie Wilson and her husband, Joe Wilson, who dared to tell the truth to the American people that Saddam Hussein wasn't getting nuclear yellow cake from Africa? that the president had lied to the American people. Do those emails show that Dick Cheney was willing to commit treason in order to prevent the lies from being exposed? I think they do. I mean, again, I haven't read them, but Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald talked about a cloud over the vice presidency. And why would Scooter Libby lie under oath, commit perjury? Who's he protecting? He only had one boss, well, two. His main boss was Vice President Dick Cheney. I guess his other boss was George W. Bush. But as Vice President Cheney's number one guy, clearly he was protecting him. So the point I raise with all these emails, and they should come out soon, is that it's vital that we have a strong Justice Department. One, we cannot move forward without looking back. I know Obama has talked about moving forward without focusing so much on the back. But you know what? Unless we respect the rule of law and prosecute those that have committed crimes, then we don't protect the future. A new book is coming out. You may have heard about it. By Washington Post investigative reporter Barton Gellman about the talk, secret talk, that Vice President Cheney had with a very strong Republican leader, Dick Armey of Texas. Now, Dick Armey and I disagree on many, many things. But one thing that Dick Armey was clear on, at least at the outset, was that there was no particular reason to fight the Iraq War. And in 2002, he was bringing a lot of people around to his view. He was getting a lot of Democrats cover, so to speak, because they said, well, if Dick Armey, number two, number three in the Republican Party, is against this war, then maybe there isn't such a strong case for war. And even all the things that Cheney had cherry-picked, all that made-up intelligence or cherry-picked intelligence, you know what cherry-picking is, of course. It's when you've got 1,000 pieces of evidence telling you that Saddam Hussein has no weapons of mass destruction and one that says he does by an agent named Curveball who the Germans told you not to trust. And it's taking the one and disregarding the 1,000 that is cherry-picking, or as the Downing Street memo so nicely put it, fixing the facts around the policy, actually making up the facts. Well, even that cherry-picked intelligence wasn't enough for Dick Armey, who at the outset was opposed to the war. So Dick Armey had a private meeting with Dick Cheney. And the book tells us where it happened, room H208. I know that room. It's a room at the Capitol. I haven't been in the room, but I know where it is. It's where Dick Cheney's office is. He has an office in the Capitol, sort of hidden away office. And he told Dick Cheney, there's the meeting of the dicks, if you will. Dick Cheney told Dick Armey that the threat from Iraq was more imminent, quote, more imminent than we want to portray to the public at large, unquote. Armey says that Cheney said, quote, Iraq's ability to miniaturize weapons of mass destruction, particularly nuclear, had been substantially refined since the first Gulf War, unquote, and would soon result in, quote, packages that could be moved even by ground personnel, unquote. A dirty bomb. A nuclear suitcase. The kind of thing you could bring in the subway and destroy a major American city. Cheney said that Hussein had direct ties to Al-Qaeda, and, quote, we now know they have the ability to develop these weapons in a very portable fashion, and they have a delivery system in their relationship with organizations such as Al-Qaeda, unquote. Now, every bit of that was false. As Gellman writes, everything he said, quote, crossed so far beyond the known universe of fact that they were simply without foundation, unquote. So here's Dick Armey. Loyal Republican, believes in all the things Republicans believe in, hating gays and, you know, supporting church control over state and all these, you know, hating government aid to poor people, all the Republican ideals, but was skeptical about the war in Iraq. And he spoke out against it. And Cheney pulled him aside and said, look, Dick Armey, I can't say these things in public, but we're really in serious danger. Iraq is about to nuke a small American city. They're going to use Al-Qaeda to deliver suitcase nuclear bombs. And soon there'll be a mushroom cloud over New York City or Houston, Texas, since Dick Armey's from Texas. And Armey switched his vote, changed his mind. In doing so, let's face it, he took away the cover that many Democrats had used, and half of them switched their votes too. Armey was asked, did Dick Cheney purposely tell me things he knew to be untrue, unquote. Armey said, quote, I seriously feel that may be the case. That Cheney told him purposely things untrue. Armey said, quote, had I known or believed then what I believe now, I would have publicly opposed the war resolution right to the bitter end, and I believe I might have stopped it from happening. So Cheney's lies may well have been the thing, the turning point, the straw that allowed the war to occur. If Cheney had not purposely told lies to Armey, we may not have gone to war in Iraq. We may have 4,000 or so servicemen and women alive, 30,000 or so not wounded, without metal arms and legs, but real arms and legs. There might be hundreds of thousands of Iraqis alive today, and millions more not exiled. But Cheney's lie touched it off. Now, are we going to explore this, or are we going to say, let bygones be bygones? It's a new era. The Bush administration was horrible, but we're moving on. Let me suggest to you that, well, as William Faulkner once said, the past is not a mere prologue. I'm paraphrasing here. But the past is not past. I just ruined it. Something like, the past is not prologue. It's not even past. Faulkner's point is the past is the present. And unless we deal with the past, we can't go on to the present. Even South Africa had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The Republicans are quietly trying to stop the Justice Department from doing its job of pursuing justice, and I call on each and every one of you to help the new president pursue justice and go after the old administration. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I'll talk about happier things and sadder things. I'm going to talk about my own experience at the inauguration. All of that and your calls when we come back right after this.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Well, what a difference a day or two makes. Obama's come in and swiftly swept house. He's put a freeze on all of Bush's pending regulations. He's put a halt to the trials in Guantanamo. He's announced the closing of that shameful pen by year's end. And he's told the CIA that it can't torture people anymore and that it can't disappear people into black sites around the world. That's a really good start, and it goes a long way to fumigating the White House and refreshing America's standing in the world. But in some ways, these were the easy steps. The hard ones are yet to come. None harder in foreign policy than resolving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has been raging for 6 decades now. To get that done, Obama's going to need to force Israel to withdraw to its 1967 borders, and that's a tough sell in Tel Aviv and in Washington. On the home front, he's got to revive this economy right away. Already times are wasting, and Obama's lowballing, and Republicans are foot-dragging. The success of his administration depends on getting these two things right, along with Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a tall order. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at CityNet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit CityNet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. If you hear that I'm hoarse, well, there's a reason for that. I've had a very busy last few days in Washington, of course, for the inauguration. I'm going to tell you what I did in just a few minutes, and I want to hear what you did, too. I want to hear, did you come to Washington? Did you watch it live? Did you watch on TV? What did you think? Are you euphoric? Are you worried about the future? Or, well, you know, what do you think about this new guy? Can you believe Bush is finally gone? Do you have to pinch yourself? But then right after Inauguration Day, Tuesday, Bob and Guy and I were all in Washington in the Senate office building for a progressive media summit. And there I asked the Majority Leader, Harry Reid, directly about the issues I just talked about with you, about prosecuting former members of the Bush administration. I said to him I'm trying to remember the exact wording of my question, but something to the effect of, we now know that Chief Justice Roberts doesn't read the Constitution very often. You'll recall that Chief Justice Roberts screwed up the 35-line presidential oath that is explicitly written in the Constitution. No other oath that anyone takes, senators, members of the House, Vice President, all of that is written in the statute, but only one oath is actually in the Constitution, word for word. And Chief Justice Roberts, who was giving the oath for the first time, Rehnquist is gone now, screwed it up. He didn't prepare. It's 35 words. Most six-year-olds can memorize 35 words, and you know what? He didn't even have to memorize it. He could have had a cheat sheet. He could have carried the Constitution with him wherever he goes, like I do. But the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court apparently doesn't feel the Constitution of the United States is important enough to carry along with him, even when he needs it to deliver the presidential oath. So, I don't know. I have some friends who are a bit conspiracy-minded, who say that because Barack Obama voted against Roberts' nomination, that he purposely messed him up. I don't know about that. I think he's just incompetent. I just don't think he's read the thing. I mean, he may have read it, but he doesn't remember it. If I'm ever Supreme Court Justice, I plan to memorize the Constitution, every single word. And if not, I'll have it available. Oh, that would be the day, right? Me on the court, actually interpreting the Constitution and applying it as it was written. Wouldn't that be a glorious thing for any justice? Anyway, Chief Justice Roberts obviously messed it up. He said did Barack Obama promise to execute I don't remember what he said exactly. I know that to faithfully execute is the correct words. He said to execute as president to the United States faithfully. I mean, he just mixed all the words around. In fact, Obama ended up not saying it accurately because of Robert's mistake, so much so that yesterday, you may have heard, they redid it. They did it over because the Constitution says you have to say all these words, and, well, they wanted to make sure that it was done accurately and no one could deny that Barack Obama was president. In any case, I said in my question to the Majority Leader, Harry Reid, I said that, you know, given that the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court doesn't feel it's that important to read the Constitution, doesn't know it very well, whether the person who appointed him, George W. Bush, and all his violations of the Constitution would be looked into, that administration and those of his staff would be looked into by the current administration. And Harry Reid said, oh, yeah, oh, we're going to investigate. And he's putting Senator Levin of Michigan on the job, and he's giving him extra money, and he's going to investigate. So lo and behold, Harry Reid left, and Senator Levin came up. And someone else in the room followed up with the question I was going to ask Senator Levin. Are we going after these guys? And Levin took the easy way out. He mentioned torture. Well, of course we should prosecute for torture. But it's more than just torture. It's surveillance without a warrant. It's secret prisons. It's holding someone in jail without trial. All of these and more. It's choosing people to work for the Justice Department based on political rather than competence criteria. It's lying to get us into war, including specific lies that Dick Cheney gave to Dick Armey that I just talked about. It's committing treason in order to protect the lies, specifically the lies that Saddam Hussein had access to nuclear materials. Well, unfortunately, I didn't get to pose the follow-up to Senator Levin, and he got away with just mentioning torture. But rest assured, I will eventually follow that up. One thing, though, I'm confident of, I don't know whether Levin will do his job. I hope he will. But I know John Conyers, and I fully expect John Conyers, head of the House Judiciary Committee, to do his job and to follow up on all of this. So that was a question I asked. I know Bob Kincaid will share with you in the next 3 hours, and he is on live tonight. What he asked Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota about coal, and I'll let you wait for Bob's show to hear Dorgan's response. I wasn't satisfied with it, and that means I know Bob was not satisfied, but I'll save that for him to talk about. I want to talk about my experience the day before at the inauguration, the reason why I'm hoarse. maybe I've had too good a time these past few days. There have been some hardships. And I do want to hear from you as well. I want to know from you what you thought of the inauguration. For me, inauguration weekend, week, I don't know what you call it, time, began on Sunday at a wonderful, wonderful concert held at the Lincoln Memorial. You may have seen it. I'm told it was on HBO and that HBO showed it for free to anyone that had cable. I know that I taped it, and so it looks to be the case. Now, except that the concert was supposed to begin with an invocation from Eugene Robinson, the bishop of the Episcopal Church in New Hampshire, the openly gay bishop, the one whose appointment caused part of the Anglican Church to desert that church. It was very important. It was a very important invocation because after Obama chose Rick Warren to give the invocation at the inauguration, many people felt that it was a heavy slap at the gay community. Rick Warren, of course, had compared gay people marrying to pedophilia or incest. So it was very important to show the gay community that Obama supported them, and that's largely what Eugene Robinson was intended to do. And We went to get there, and we noticed as we walked over the hill, we came from the Washington Monument. In fact, it was so crowded that we couldn't get down very close to Lincoln Memorial, but there were the jumbotrons. It was estimated some 650,000 people were there that day on Sunday. Well, we heard Gene Robinson's invocation, but apparently you, the rest of the American people, did not. Now, people are pointing fingers. It is true that the invocation began at about 2:23 or so, and the concert was supposed to begin at 2:30. So HBO didn't carry it live. The other networks weren't allowed to carry it. HBO had exclusive rights. Wonder where that money goes. Where does that money go, HBO paying for its exclusive rights? Does it go to the Obama campaign? Does it go to the federal government? I have to look into that. Anyway, HBO didn't start till 2:30. And by then, well, conveniently, the gay bishop was hustled off the stage. And if you just watched HBO, you might not even know he was there. So whose fault is it? HBO says it's the inaugural committee's fault. They had him start early. And the inaugural committee says it's HBO's fault. They didn't record it. Could it have just been an innocent mistake? Or were they trying to hide the gay bishop from the larger American public? I don't know the answer to that, but it bears looking into. I don't mean to be so negative. There was a lot of very, very positive things. The concert itself was beautiful. I could see it on the jumbotrons. Some of the shorter people I was with could not. I feel bad for them. But we could hear everything beautifully, and it was quite a concert. Some Bruce Springsteen and Garth Brooks and Stevie Wonder brought down the house. In fact, I have some pictures of it. Take a look. Go to my website, radioinsidescoop.com. It shows pictures of the crowds, the jumbotron, the Lincoln Memorial beyond. It really was a beautiful day. And the crowd was having a great time. Lots and lots of faces, lots of African Americans, lots of young people, but, you know, white, black, Latino, Asian, young and old, lots of babies, people in their 80s, everyone in between. We were all dancing and singing and laughing and getting to know each other. People from all over the country, lots from California. I met people from New York, Tennessee, Texas, Massachusetts, Chicago, Washington State, and you know, lots of locals, too, and the crowd would chant Obama. But really, to me, it was more like July 4th than a political rally. Because people weren't talking specifics about what they wanted Obama to do. They weren't condemning Bush. They were just enjoying being American again. Flags and children, and it was a good time. There's not a single protest sign that I saw. And the inauguration was pretty much the same way. Now, I had a bad experience at the inauguration, which I hesitate to share with you. I will, because you need to know the truth. But I hesitate to share with it because I didn't want it to mar that day. And it did. But, you know, it didn't. In the scheme of things, it didn't. I felt bad really more for my friends I was with than for myself. I'll tell you what happened. I was a silver ticket holder. You see, if you worked in the campaign, as I did, or if you helped the Democratic Party, they gave you tickets that were to allow you to have better seats. Now, I wasn't up there with the real big muckety-mucks, the ones in the yellow and orange seats, or the other muckety-mucks in the blue and purple seats. I was silver tickets, which was, I guess, one step ahead of no tickets, but behind the ones that actually could sit down and watch the show from the Capitol steps. And it was a great day. I came with my friends. They had purple tickets. And we took a water taxi crossing the river. Beautiful ship. Came there very excited, very happy about the day. And we went to go. And about 9:30 or so, 2.5 hours ahead of time, we were there. And by 10, the crowd hadn't moved a bit. 10:30, the crowd hadn't moved a bit, maybe a few inches here and there. And there was no one telling us what to do or where to go. And it was very frustrating to watch the minutes click and to see tens of thousands of us, silver ticket holders, without access to the silver ticket area. We could see it was there. It was right in front of us. It was behind this barrier. It was completely, not completely blank, but about two-thirds blank. The police or the organizers, really the organizers, I blame Senator Feinstein, frankly, for this, and also Senator Bennett of Utah. They were the two in charge of the congressional organizing. They were in charge of this specific ticket holder area. Hadn't planned. Even though they knew exactly how many ticket holders that were there, about half the number that usually come for July 4th in the ticketed areas, and there were maybe 8, 10, 12 cops doing security. There just weren't enough. Anyway, I did manage to wend my way through the crowd, and just before the invocation began, I did manage to get on the mall in my spot. But a bunch of silver ticket holders did not and were stuck behind the barriers until, I remember, soon, right before Joe Biden became vice president, I heard the sound of a barrier falling and a big roar as tens of thousands of people didn't go through security. They just went right into their settled area. And, you know, that was just fine by me. We were too far away to be any kind of a threat to the president. And these are people, most of them, who worked very hard to get Obama elected. But it did somewhat mar my enjoyment of the day. I felt bad for the people behind the barriers. And frankly, some people with better tickets, purple and blue tickets, had it worse than I. They were stuck in tunnels, stuck behind security. There's even a Facebook page, the Purple Tunnel of Doom. They didn't have to do it this way. They had a year to plan for this event. They knew exactly, you know, you could argue that they didn't know how many people would be in the unticketed areas. And, you know, there turned out to be 2 million, but they actually did okay. They could see from the jumbotrons, it was those of us that worked hard that really were mistreated. And, of course, the best ticket holders, the yellow and orange, did quite well. I talked to Guy James. He was a yellow ticket holder. He had a fantastic view. So, yeah, there's a little bit of envy here. I admit that. But eventually, though, we were there. And despite all the problems, there was obviously there was joy in the crowd. There was seriousness. There was happiness. More serious, obviously, than the concert that had been just a few days earlier. I think with Barack Obama's quite somber inaugural speech, I mean, I didn't hear anything celebratory about it. He was telling America, look, we're in a big mess. He was trying to set the bar low, to remind Americans how deep the hole was that George Bush had dug us and how long it would take to move out. And by the way, just because I'm telling my story doesn't mean you can't tell yours. There's still a little bit of time if you want to call in. 877-4HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. I want to hear your experience, whether you were at the mall or not, if you want to join us. But I can tell you that the crowd, it was a weird, I don't know. Some were sad. Sad's the wrong word. Let's just say moved. Emotional, that's a better word. Some were happy and excited and dancing. But most, I think, were recognizing the drama of the moment, the power of the moment, the way that the American people had finally gotten their choice as President of the United States. No Supreme Court was involved. No voters turned away at the polls. But just the understanding that for once we were in charge and our guy was going to be president soon. You know, the only other inauguration I've attended was in 2001, where I was protesting the inaugural, when I was demanding that the people's choice be seated. In the 2 million people on the mall, and now I've watched a lot of it on television, I got a better view on television, I got to say, than I saw in the crowd. So those of you that watched on TV, don't feel bad. But as I looked out over the mall, I saw not a single protester. I saw not a single person complaining. I saw only hope and maybe a small wisp of melancholy, of fear. Almost as if people were saying, and I wrote this on my blog, we've put our last best hopes in you, Obama. Our hopes, fears, and lives rest on your shoulders. We trust you. We love you. But for God's sake, don't let us down. And I think Obama's speech touched exactly that mix of hope and excitement and a whiff of melancholy. We are in a very deep economic trouble. We are not fighting two wars very well. Indeed, our enemies, it appears, are in countries that we're not even in, right? Pakistan. So, Obama's got a lot on his plate. And I think the biggest thing he has on his plate is the bent-up frustrations, the pent-up frustrations of all the years, long years of Republican rule. Everyone wants everything Obama promised right now. We want universal health care. We want a way out of this economic depression. We want troops out of Iraq. We want to feel safe and secure. We want our Constitution and our laws respected. We want education for everyone, not just the rich. We want equal opportunity. We want civil rights. Gay people want the right to be treated the same as straight people. We want an end to hate crimes. Residents of the District of Columbia want the right to participate in America's democracy. And the environment, more than anything, those of us that elected Obama, I don't know more than anything. We all have, I guess, our own individual things we want. But it seems the most important thing for our economy and for our future is going green, is getting us off of foreign oil and even domestic oil. I mean, it's amazing how many things come together when you talk about getting rid of fossil fuels and going to wind and solar and other renewable energy sources. It helps our economy. It brings jobs. It helps people get to work. It helps our environment. It helps stop global warming and the extinction of species like the polar bear. It helps with cleaner air and cleaner water to get rid of fossil fuels. And it also helps our foreign policy. It means that the dictators of Saudi Arabia don't necessarily have to control U.S. foreign policy. It means that we don't have to be giving so much American treasure to the very people who are out to murder so many Americans. Al-Qaeda is funded every time you fill up your SUV. So it helps us in foreign policy. It helps us on our environment. It helps us with jobs. And that's where I think a large part of Obama's stimulus package is going to go. There are other things. Soon to come up, of course, is the Employee Free Choice Act. The idea that Americans have a right, American workers have a right to join a union and to join it without intimidation by their employers. And if enough people want to join a union, if majority want to join, they get to join. Basic stuff. The stuff that American workers have been denied for too long in an economy when those at the top get more and more wealthy and those in the middle and at the bottom lose. So there are a lot of hopes, a lot of dreams, a lot of policies on this man's thin shoulders. And he can't do it alone. He needs our help. And the first thing we can do is call out the Republicans when they declare war on this man who's trying so hard to bring hope and change to America. I will see you next week. I will hopefully have my voice back in that time. Next up, your hillbilly elitist, Bob Kincaid. This is Mark Levine, signing off.